So the thoughts are just spiraling out of control. And I step into that dreadful HR office and they say, Meredith, you've done a great job here. However, there's been a mistake with your commissions and we've overpaid you a little bit and we're going to need that money back. So dang, like that really stinks. In my mind, I'm thinking, what is this? $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 for last month. Okay. You know, I'm going to eat top ramen for the month and make up for it. And next month we'll be good again. Well, Meredith, it's a little bit more than that. It's actually been going on since you started here 2 years ago, and it's going to be about $60,000.
This is Taking the Lead, a podcast for B2B tech professionals, leaders, and executives who want to learn from female icons in the tech industry. In each episode, host Christina Brady interviews women who are driving revenue for some of the most respected tech companies in the world. Are you ready to get inspired?
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Taking the Lead. I am welcoming my guest, Meredith, today. Meredith, welcome to the show.
Hi. So beyond excited to be here, thrilled to be here.
I love a thrilled guest. I am also thrilled. And speaking of thrilled, I am thrilled to talk about Taking the Lead's fantastic partners. If you have not heard of them, they are Women in Sales and Renegade Operations. Women in Sales, let's start with them. They are focused on elevating, empowering, and promoting women within the sales profession. And in order to realize this vision and create a more equitable sales team in the future, they recognize everyone has to be a part of that conversation and contribute towards the progress. We are talking about a community of well over 10,000 incredible women from AEs all the way up to C-suite. And if you want to get involved in women in sales, I've got great news for you. It is free. You can head over to www.women-in-sales.com and join the conversation on Slack. And let's talk about Renegade Operations, another female-founded company. And if you find yourself sitting and struggling with growing revenue and traditional frameworks and tactics, prepare to challenge the status quo and unleash untapped revenue potential with Renegade Operations. As I mentioned, it is a women-owned RevOps consultancy with over 16 years in direct sales, operations, and enablement. They are going to help you out if you are ready to revolutionize your revenue. Head over to renegadeoperations.com to learn more. And with that, Meredith, I would love to learn more about you. Tell us your journey. Tell us your tale. How did you get where you are?
Yes. So it's kind of a funny and some parts are not so funny story. So we'll just dive into it.
Any good movie.
Plot twists everywhere.
Plot twists everywhere. Isn't that the journey of a woman? Guess what? Plot twist. Just for you. Tell us about it.
This is a woman's life. So after college, I actually lived in Spain for a few years. I was teaching English. And I'm from San Francisco, and everyone kept saying tech and sales, the market is so hot. This was when 2014, 2015, when it was really hot. And I absolutely loved living in Europe, but I just got so many calls from friends working at really exciting tech companies saying, you're made for sales, you got to come back and get into this now. So I pulled the plug, moved back to San Francisco, started working at a little company called Yelp. Maybe some of you have heard of it. It's funny, we used to do cold calling there, obviously, and a lot of people, I had the territory of farmers, central region of California. And so we'd call and we'd say, hi, I'm from Yelp. And people would say, Yelp, what? Is that the sound a dog makes? Is that like a dog barking?
Well, it is, but not why I'm calling.
Yes, not this time anyway. So it was a great start. They had a fantastic training program. I knew that going into it. They put us through a 90-day rigorous sales training, the ins and outs for anyone that had zero sales experience. So it was really great that way. We had to make 80 cold calls a day and speak on the phone for 2.5 hours of talk time. So this was thankfully still in the days of when movie theaters would put their, what would you call them, their schedules on a landline, right? So exactly, yeah. So one of our listeners might not be able to relate to this because now we're in the internet era completely, but you would call the movie theater and it would say the showtime for The Little Mermaids is as follows, or the showtimes for The Little Mermaid is as follows: 9 a.m., 11:20 a.m., 1 p.m. And so you, as much as you want to hit your sales quota, they were equally concerned with your talk time and your call volume. So a lot of times you're just listening to movie theater times.
I'm screaming internally and not externally, because we also learned to hold that in. But it's funny. Well, you were working at, well, it might have been a little bit after, but coming from Groupon, where I know Groupon and Yelp at times like played in similar spaces, it was the same thing where it was like this number of dials, this amount of talk time. They had introduced this metric that was like qualified calls, which was it had to be at least 2 minutes. And in case you're wondering, you can re-record a voicemail on a corporate line until it hits 2 minutes, and then you're good to go. And so are you saying you gamified cold calls because it's a ridiculous metric to track?
We had our fun with it where we could. That's a good insider tip for any of our listeners or any of your listeners tuned in looking, still needing those tricks. There was a positive side though. So sometimes you'd get a gatekeeper, and we were calling small, medium businesses. And so you'd get a gatekeeper and so-and-so is out to lunch. Oh, well, where'd they go? What'd they order? Oh, that sounds like a good sandwich. What do you normally order?
I'll pass you eat it. You just get weird.
Do you eat the bread when you get that sandwich, or do you prefer it cold?
Scratch the roof of your mouth. I don't know. Well, gotta go.
So you would get those rapport building skills to a degree, but didn't stay around Yelp much longer than I think 9 months. I had learned as much as I thought I could learn from there, then went to a different tech company. And this tech company was interesting in that you had two quotas. So you had a new business quota and the model was month to month. So in order to incentivize retention, they had a total revenue quota as well. So you're out there hunting, but you also need to protect and grow what you have. And so I was doing really well at this company. I was a top rep out of hundreds. The money's coming in. I'm 26 years old. I'm not counting the pennies. And there's so many different rules and different parts of the commission's plan that, you know, when you're making money, you're not counting the pennies, right? It's only when you're not making the money that you're in your budget every day.
It's because everyone's asking for the money that you don't have. Yeah,
exactly. So I'm there for 2 years, top of my game. Plot twist, I go in on what must have been, plot twist number one, I go in on what must have been just a regular Tuesday, Wednesday morning. HR pulls me into a room, which you know is never good. And so you're immediately thinking, oh my God, they really can read our G-chats, which again, shout out to the audience. This is before Slack and everything was in Gmail. you're thinking, oh my gosh, they're bringing Big Brother us up in here. So the thoughts are just spiraling out of control. And I step into that dreadful HR office and they say, Meredith, you've done a great job here. However, there's been a mistake with your commissions and we've overpaid you a little bit and we're going to need that money back. So dang, like that really stinks. In my mind, I'm thinking, what is this? $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 for last month. Okay. You know, I'm going to eat top ramen for the month and make up for it. And next month we'll be good again. Well, Meredith, it's a little bit more than that. It's actually been going on since you started here 2 years ago, and it's going to be about $60,000. Yeah.
What?
Yes, my reaction exactly.
And you're so, like, great news. I found myself randomly with an extra $60,000, and I had no idea where it came from. I've got it right here for you. I can write you a check today. I have my checkbook in my bag, because it's about as archaic as this is. I'm on the edge of my seat. So what did you do?
Exactly. So I tried to work with them and I said, you know, over 2 years, a lot of this money is invested. I paid taxes on this money to move this around is going to cost me a lot. Can we work together on the money from this year? Because I don't think I've invested that yet. I don't think I've, you know, paid taxes on it. Like, that's going to stink because that's still going to be 20, 30 grand, but let's work on it for this year, or I'll work out a payback plan. Even though I should never have even been in that seat to begin with, I'm sitting there thinking, why are you talking to me? Why are you not talking to finance? Why are you not talking to ops? Why are you not talking to the commissions analyst? And so they said, you know what, Meredith, actually in the state of California, the law states that even if you go into a grocery store and you're supposed to get a $10 bill back and you get a 20, you are required by law to give the 20 back to the person that incorrectly tendered it in the first place. And if you don't want to give this money back, then we will go to other remedies to collect it. Yes. So very shocking for, I was 26 years old at the time, maybe 27. Very shocking. And on the other hand, Christina, I'm bringing in $1.5 million a year. $50,000 to $60,000 for this company was pennies. They're a huge household name. And so I just couldn't understand not only the rationale or the ethics behind doing this to somebody, but also the economics didn't make sense to me. And so I had to seek legal advice, and we were continuing to work it out with them. And I couldn't leave because that would be admitting guilt, et cetera. Anyways, it got very legal. And so they tried to push me out. And things that they did to do this were they raised my quota, which I then hit. So they had to pay me out even more.
This is wild.
And then they started a coup in the office. So they were telling my colleagues and coworkers, and some of them were friends at the time, not to spend time with me, not to eat lunch with me, because I needed to leave. And so there were only two people in the office at this time, and I'll never forget their friendship. And I'm so thankful to these two men, actually, to this day. They still would go out to lunch with me every day, even though they would get other pings from people like, hey, why would you want to associate yourself with her? You're up for promotion. You see how this looks. Again, I did nothing wrong here. And so the plot thickens in that we're kind of in this head-to-head. She can't leave. We can't push her out because if we push her out, it's retaliation, et cetera. Again, got very legal. And unfortunately, I was then sexually harassed.
Oh, my God.
And I don't want to say fortunately, but was able to leverage that event for an exit.
The fact that you had to, I mean, what's looking back on this experience, one, it likely left you with a lot of trauma and mistrust in organizations as a whole. And secondly, the distraction and the going off track and the amount of dollars lost by taking somebody who is an amazing performer and putting them through this situation is unbelievable. And this is the element of corporations that I simply can't understand. And on top of that, what I've learned is this industry is very, very small, right? Everybody knows each other, and every person that you treat like garbage holds on to that experience with them. And they tell stories like this. And the fact that you had to take what would have been a secondary negative and it wound up being this really strange collateral damage level way for you to get out of another terrible situation, it's unbelievable. It's unbelievable.
That you had to
use your trauma and your experience to almost like the enemy of my enemy is my friend. This is just like via the transitive property, we have somehow ended at you're able to resolve this. And then you move on. You go somewhere. Did you need to take some time off to like heal? What happened next?
Yeah, that was absolutely terrible. And fast forwarding a few roles, which we'll get to, it led me to the commission's space. So ever since then, I have been adamant about checking every commission statement and making sure that I'm paid accurately, whether that is fairly according to plan or if there's something in my favor, which rarely, you know, just like the bank statements, you know, you never catch an error in your favor. But if you do, bring it up early and often, just not only fear, but fairness for the employer too. I want to do right by everyone, but I, for a long time, couldn't share that story. And it's something I'm very passionate about. And I want to implore everybody to understand your commissions plans as soon as you step into a seat. If you cannot calculate the plans on your own, you need to get crystal clear with your boss or leadership on what the plans are, because mistakes happen, right? And we're all human. And just like we make mistakes as sales reps, the people calculating commissions can make mistakes. And that's completely fine. And I've never run into any degree of the extremity of this issue, but I do like to put it out there for the world that you should be checking your statements regularly and just making sure that everything looks squared away. So from there, oh, go ahead.
Well, you can see my face. I'm just like, oh, this is phenomenal advice that everybody should take in. And the great news is I have never heard of a company with an overly complicated commission plan that isn't super easy to track, right? Like, no, this happens because most companies do overcomplicate their commissions plans and they're living out of Excel spreadsheets and they're trying to motivate their people as best they can by altering the way that they're compensated to the point where you almost require your AEs and CSMs and BDRs to be analysts to try to figure out how much they're getting paid on a deal. And so not only is there sage advice in understand how you are paid, and if you do not have a way to inspect it, you speak to your manager immediately. And second, for companies that are building these compensation plans, I get it. I've been a revenue leader for a really long time, and sometimes you just get ahead of your skis. If people cannot easily calculate how they're compensated, it actually hurts their ability to be successful and feel passionate and excited about the work that they do. You ideally want every one of your revenue-facing roles to know exactly how much they're going to make on that deal or that renewal or that upsell, because you can use that to motivate. And if you are hearing Meredith's story, this is incredibly demotivating, which will cost you way more than the $50,000 or $60,000 mistake over 2 years, which, look, is a one big number. That sounds like a lot, but over 2 years, like, most people wouldn't have caught that. It's not like you were getting an extra $10,000 every month. Like, well, this is a bit above average, but exactly. I'm going to go with it. Like, it's like little fractions. It's like little bits where you probably wouldn't even notice it.
That's exactly what happened. And when I asked them to send me the printout of the rules on each deal, right? Because I had 100 accounts each month. So it's 100 line items and 3 different payouts per account. They sent me, Christina, I kid you not, they printed it out, 70-page printout of Excel files and expected me to be able to calculate and catch the errors. So, yes, to your point.
What a great use of AE time.
To my defense, it wasn't like I got one lump sum of 60 grand and, you know, was on the run there. But yeah, to your point, it's extremely distracting. I probably spent half of my work time trying to figure out what had gone wrong and trying to loop other people. Hey, can you explain to me this? So you're absolutely right. Big advocate for commission clarity.
Yes. So you learned an interesting lesson that you are now sharing with the rest of the world. And that is a gift. And you're about to tell us where you went next.
Yes. My next step before I wound up in the commission space itself, because of this incident, which I'm still so passionate about, I wound up at it was a very small startup at the time. It was called, or it is called, Samsara. They're now publicly traded. I was, I think, rep number 10 there. I was one of the youngest reps. I was actually just so surprised that I even got an offer there because it was extremely competitive at the time. There were a lot of really unique interview tactics and tests and some things that I don't think still exist today. But it was just a very uniquely set of extremely smart people, not only running the place there, leadership, but also the peers. And so I just wanted to be around all these smart people. And I'm so glad that I am, because the reps that I got in there selling with are still my closest friends today. They're people I invest with. They're people I learn from. We do house sharing. We do, house sharing. We'll rent each other's places out. I'm just constantly learning, getting book ideas, course recommendations, business ideas from this group of people. And I will credit to Samsara in that they kept the bar for talent and hiring there extremely high. They did not let anyone in the door. And it really showed you were constantly being elevated by the person to the right of you, to the left of you. And so I really have to commend them on that. And I tried to take that with me when I ended up hiring at future places.
Well, the idea of punching above your weight class, right? Like, and what is it? A rising tide raises all ships. Yeah.
That's exactly true. Right. Yeah. I was in way over my head coming from Yelp and this other company, they were freemium versions and small, medium business. And here I am selling a software and a hardware and a subscription. And yeah, it was way above my head. And I was actually struggling the first quarter. I was not at my quota still the first or the last week of the quarter. And they were also very cutthroat in that you cannot miss a quarter. If you miss, like, you get pipped immediately. So again, high bar for hiring and high bar for attainment, but you knew what to expect, right? It was black and white. They didn't change the rules for anyone, which I also really admire. So the stakes were high, but that's because the rewards were going to be high. And we see that in that they went public, and I did make some money there, which in the end was worth it. But my last week there, or I'm sorry, the last week of the first quarter, I was not at quota. And the VP at the time said, well, I need to see you in the office at 5 a.m. making cold calls then. And that was scary coming from, you know, these recognizable household names where, you know, I'm calling movie lines. But I got my butt in the door at 5 a.m. It was still dark out. I made, 120 dials instead of the usual 80 or 90. And on the second to last day of the quarter, I was able to secure a PO for, I think, like 130% of my quota. And from there, just the trajectory of my career changed forever, because from Samsara, I became one of their most successful reps. I was breaking records there left and right. I learned a lot about creating a winning culture there, which I took on to many other places, gone into management there, and then from there jumped back into the commission space because I was still very scarred from that certain experience and just had an innate passion. This is going to sound weird for commissions, but we're all salespeople. So I think deep down, everyone's kind of innately passionate about commissions, right?
I hope so. I hope so, because we do a lot of suffering for those commissions. But we also, we also have a lot of fun. And I think that that's the balance, is anybody that is getting commissions for work done, it's a difficult job. It's an emotional job. There's a lot of differing thoughts on fairness and control, right? Like, you can't control a ton. And even the things you can control, like, get into the office at 5 a.m. Like, I hope you were calling a different time zone, because who's answering the phone at 5 a.m., right? So it's like, it comes with that, but then with passion comes fun. And I feel like a theme, and when you're talking about your journey and where you light up and talk about things that went really, really well, it was this element of safety at work. It was an element of learning at work. It was an element of fun at work. And your passion was bred from your struggle. And I think a lot of people who do powerful things, they feel the struggle first, and then it ignites something of like, how do I prevent this from happening to other people? Gosh, and that's bravery, and that's trailblazing. Like, we just defined it. So now what do you do today? Tell us.
Yes, today I'm head of sales for a company called PClub.io. My founder was the VP at Gong previously, so he's also very well renowned in the space, and I've always looked up to him as a thought leader. And because of my leadership roles previously and being one of the first reps at many companies, I'm coming in here and building the sales team from the ground floor. So to your point of fun via struggle, our company, PClub, is meant to it's a play on President's Club, right? And so it gives salespeople the skills they need to up-level their careers and ultimately go to their President's Club. So I get to talk to sales leaders all day, every day, which is equally rewarding and challenging, but I get to hear a lot about the fun aspects that you mentioned, such as where is your President's Club this year? And then I recall some of my President's Clubs. If I'm still thinking about Samsara and some of the fun moments, they threw the best President's Clubs ever. And the inaugural one, we went to the island of Lanai in Hawaii, which is that private island. Have you heard of it?
No, I just want to go to Hawaii again.
Yeah, it's a private island. The Four Seasons there is $1,500 a night. The bidet itself had like 15 different settings.
Zing!
Yeah, it was quite an incredible trip. So here's to foreshadowing many more presidential trips in my future.
I mean, the fun is so important, but I feel like it's missed so much. Or do you find that sales leaders, but leadership in general mischaracterizes what fun at work actually is? Like, I remember when I was interviewing either for roles or interviewing people to come at various companies that I've been at. And I would always ask them, what's important to you at a company that you come and work for? And they'd always be like, well, you know, leadership, and I want to make a lot of money. And they'd be like, I want fun. Like, I want a fun culture. And I was like, I love that. Great. Like, how do you define a fun culture? And they'd always say something like, well, you know, like cold brew on tap and, you know, a ping pong table. And it was like this very strange sort of like, I think that we feel like we have to say, we're going to have fun at work. We're going to have fun at work. But it's work, right? How do you balance those two things in a way that actually makes sense and doesn't just come across like buzzwords?
That's such a great point, Christina, because I think sadly, a lot of sales leaders miss the mark on making sales fun or enjoyable. I recently read a book, and I wish I remembered it, but I read something recently that reminded me that, well, it states this point blank, we spend 30% of our lives at work. It was something like 90,000 hours of our lifetime is spent at work. So it's like, why not make it enjoyable, right? And there's actually so many ways to make it enjoyable. And the first objection you'll hear is, well, it's really hard in a remote world. It's really not. I'm going to challenge anyone who believes that, because it's really not that challenging. I've managed, what, three teams now remotely, and we have a ton of fun. There's so much you can do.
Now you have to tell us what you can do, because I guarantee every single person is like, I mean, I tried doing happy hours where everyone got their own drink on Zoom, and we thought it would be fun, and it wasn't fun. And I'm like, right, because everyone just worked a full day and now they have to go get their own alcohol and sit in front of their computer and look at their coworkers some more while they drink. And I was like, at some point, someone thought that would be fun. Like, have you ever been a human before? So what are some ways?
Absolutely.
You can actually have fun. And I mean, I love you're honing in on this remote setting, because I think even organizations where people are starting to come back to the office, like your customers could be remote. Like we are in a remote world, period. It's going to happen. So like, what are some ways that you can have fun?
Yeah. And I think you raised such a good point. People are so zoomed out. The last thing they want is another Zoom after Zoom. And so there's definitely activities and events that we'll touch on, but it stems way before that in the more simplistic acts of just getting to know your direct reports on an individual level. So aside the fact of just wanting to make work more enjoyable, when people enjoy their work, they're going to be more productive. So even if you don't, quote unquote, believe in fun, if we want to make this more logical and economical, if people are bought into you as their leader or the company, they feel like they're being seen, heard, and valued, they're going to produce more. So whether or not, again, you quote unquote believe in fun, it is to your benefit to figure out a way to make your direct reports enjoy their job. And so a few things I've done that I think are really worthwhile is starting out on day one with your direct reports by just having an open conversation with them. And so things that I've done in the past that have worked really well, and again, it's because I'm in sales and this works really well, but usually in a group setting, I like to ask the new direct report, what do you like to spend your money on? What's the best commission purchase you've ever made? What's the worst commissions purchase you ever made? And that one was funny because my previous team at Captivate IQ, we all had the same worst purchase in that we all bought this shiny object stock at the height and then it dropped. So we all eight of us had lost tremendous amounts of money on Bitcoin. Things like that, Bitcoin or like, you know, certain stocks. And so we named our team buy high, sell low, which is the opposite of buying low and selling high. But it was a way for us to connect. We would have never learned that we all have that in common. But then you have people who are saving up for engagement rings and people that just want to travel the world. And I had one direct report. He was super into tiny homes. So he would just buy these $20,000, $30,000 tiny homes and like plop them on his existing properties. And you just get to learn so much about people by asking these simple questions.
Getting to know your people. Like, yes. I have to ask a question about the tiny homes person. Do you mean like he bought a bunch of tiny homes and put all of them on his property, meaning he had one big home made up of a bunch of little tiny homes, or every property he had, or did he just like strategically like little Monopoly houses, place them like on Baltic Avenue and then did it?
So the one that I know of is he had an Airbnb property, and so he put the separate tiny home on top of it, which I tried to advise him against. I said, I don't know if the Airbnbs in the expensive Miami house are going to want tiny home people kind of like using the same pool, but
right,
you know, go for it.
Tiny home people. I feel like it's got to be a similar person to, have you ever seen the people who build the really extravagant tree houses?
Yes.
They've got to be a similar folk. Perhaps they're kin. Point being, and we could talk about this forever.
About tiny homes forever.
Yeah, and the people who reside in them. But
for your next podcast,
your next podcast, right? There's no judgment there. I gotta go find somebody because there's something to this. But the idea of instead of trying to force the fun, and instead of trying to take up calendar time, you can make activities that are inherently not fun more fun by leaning into your culture, encouraging people to be themselves, celebrating laughter, not taking ourselves too seriously. Like those are all of what I heard you say. And even when I think back to the last couple of weeks at my company, right? Like we are right now hardcore building product and it's difficult, but every single meeting that we've had, we're laughing and we're having fun and we're energized and we're getting to know each other and we're respecting each other and we're building these relationships. And it is the culture that happens first, and then and only then can fun follow. And I've always said that you actually can't have fun in an environment where it's not safe, right? Like fun and lack of safety cannot exist in the exact same place. And the last question that I have before we kind of pivot into rapid reveal is, doing what you do, I would imagine that you come across a lot of companies that have a lot of fear that's sitting there, and there's a lot of leadership that are trying to throw fun at the fear to get rid of the fear. What advice would you have for leaders that have a company that has a lot of fear right now for a lot of reasons in terms of how you get rid of the fear before you can have the fun?
That's a really good question. So there's definitely a lot of fear for many reasons, right? The market is what it is. Maybe leadership overpromised is under delivering on the role itself. Maybe the role is not what they expected. And so they're just trying to, you know, put the puzzle pieces together. So yeah, there's definitely a lot of fear out there. I think as leaders, we have to get our reps to trust us. And I think that comes from mutual expectation setting. So again, day one, you want to be very clear with your reps. This is what I expect from you. I expect you to be collaborative with the team. I expect you to, you know, attend team meetings and play an active role. And I expect you to do everything in your power to get to your number. And I also expect you to come to me for help. And this is what you can expect from me. You can expect that I'm going to train you and coach you and develop you. And I can listen to X calls a week. And I will be your advocate. And I will do that through this, that, and the third. So I think the fun comes after the mutual expectations have been set. Some things that I share with my team is, again, you can expect that I'm going to coach train you. I'm going to listen to these calls. Don't expect me to be a product expert. Like, I have 10 of you, and skills in management and leadership are about development. I rarely get on product calls. So don't expect that from me. Just like I don't expect you to respond to my Slacks after hours. I might send you one because it's top of mind and I don't want it to slip. But I, by all means, don't expect you to respond at 8 p.m. So I think once that accountability, the fun can begin. And I think we were just kind of touching on some fun ideas, Christina. So I wanted to just throw a few more out there for the group because in today's market, budgets are tight. And so, again, those little activities of, you know, what do you like to spend your commissions on? What was your best purchase? Some things I've done with teams in the past, and again, this is dependent on your budget, but it shouldn't take much, but team bingo. So we would make bingo cards, and you can put your incentives there for certain behaviors you want to drive. And so, for example, the last ones I ran, we had book a meeting via cold call was a square. Book a meeting via LinkedIn was a square. Increase your, you know, ACV by X dollars was a square. And if you got a line across something small, like an Uber Eats gift card. But every week we would meet with the team and we would share our winnings. And we also had kind of fun squares on there, right? Like through team meetings, you're naturally going to have some fun jokes or slogans. And those would be squares, like say this ridiculousness to a client. And so we'd have, you know, the line across is Uber Eats, and the X would be a 3-month coffee subscription to Worldly Coffees around the world, which was only $100. And then the square blackout was a spa day, $200. And so there's just a lot of ways to get people bought in. Obviously, if you can do a quarterly event, that's amazing. We did a lot of really cool events at Captivate IQ quarterly. Airbnb Experiences is great for this. I don't know if people know that exists. You're nodding your head, so I'm guessing you do.
But like, I bet a lot of people don't. So keep going. I'm just enjoying this. I'm like, this is a great list. Keep going.
Yes. So Airbnb, we all know you can book housing anywhere in the world. You can also now book experiences through them anywhere in the world. So if you know you're going to, I'll just say San Francisco because that's where I live. You can look at experiences and it'll say, ride your bike over the Golden Gate Bridge. Yay. Well, now they have virtual experiences. So you can book dumpling making with somebody's grandma in Asia, or you can book a virtual safari with somebody who lives in South Africa and they take you along on their big camera set and they show you the animals up front. So a lot of things that we did, again, at Captivate IQ is, and we were fortunate enough to get small, medium budget approved every quarter, just about $50, $70 per head. But we did things like an improv class. We did an improv class. We did a murder mystery together. We did kind of like a comedy show. We did a game show type thing. One quarter, we were really balling on a budget and we did our makeshift MTV Cribs episode. And so everyone would walk us through their house and you got to see how they lived and they'd have to take their Zoom background off. So there's so much out there on Airbnb experiences, and the reps, I'd always let the reps choose and they'd, you know, volunteer ideas and then we'd vote on them. So there's just so many fun things that reps want to do. So I'd highly encourage that, because then you get to see how your direct reports really live. You know, you see the people they live with walking through the house with you. And so it's very eye-opening, definitely builds team camaraderie. And then if you can swing an on-site, always recommend one of those per year.
Yes, that you truly the face-to-face connection and the magic of being in a room together, it's always going to be powerful. And speaking of powerful, like, what a cool list full of amazing ideas. You know, you hit me right in the heart when you talked about improv workshops. I lead those and I can't evangelize enough how amazing it is to train your people how to think on their feet with something like that. And it's like every one of those things involved learning, involved doing the job, and it didn't involve forcing people to drink on camera on Zoom. And so you heard the amazing list here. And that's a perfect segue to now just dive even deeper into your brain, your experiences. And I've got three questions for you for our rapid reveal section, if you are ready.
Yes, hit me.
Okay, you've got 60 seconds or less to answer each. Number one, what was the first paid job that you ever had?
First paid job was babysitting at age 12, which, looking back on it, I think is ludicrous that anyone would entrust their small children with a 12, 13. And you see it all the time. People hire younger girls all the time to babysit. I used to run an ad. Again, I'm dating myself, in the newspaper, everybody. And I'd also print flyers out on my home printer and staple them to the telephone poles. And they'd have those little things that say, take a number. And people would call me and they'd, you know, pay me $7 an hour. But it's like, I'm sorry, if something happens to your child, I can't drive.
I'm not insured.
I am a child watching your child.
I am literally a child. I am in the sixth or seventh grade. I am irresponsible. I am hormonal. And I'm watching your baby. Yeah, I was a terrible babysitter. I also hated it. I never wanted to take on babysitting. My older sister, she was only a year older than me. She's like, loved babysitting. She's like, I love it. And so she had all these customers. And then whenever she couldn't make it because of her social life, she'd be like, my sister can do it. And I'd be like, I don't like other people's kids, when I was a kid. And so I'd be like, what do you guys, I will literally let you do whatever you want to do if you leave me alone. Like, just whatever. So was a terrible babysitter, which is funny because I'm a parent now. Make your own judgments. All right. Number two. What's an irrational fear of yours?
An irrational fear of mine is anything other than inbox zero every single day. So I'm very psychotic about this. Well, one person could say psychotic. I prefer the term hyperly organized. Hyperly organized. So every day, inbox has to hit zero. My friends hate this part. My text messages also have to read zero. So like, if we're in a text and you reply, gets deleted, that note, that way I know I responded to it, hyperly organized. But then people will be like, remember that time where I said this 3 months ago? And I'm like, no, like, we sorted that. We're moving on. When I see people who have like 21,000 unread emails, like, my heart palpitates.
You feel fear for that. I get it. So what I'm hearing is, don't email you at like 11:59 because you're about to be like, I've done it. I've completed another day. And that inbox bombs that one. And you're like, I got to answer this. Noted. We're not going to do that. Number three, what is a skill that you've always wanted to learn? And what's stopping you from learning it?
I always wish I learned stick shift when I lived in Europe, but the public transportation was just so incredible. You didn't really need a car. And now that I live in America again, everything's automatic. So I'd love to go back to learning, to try to learn it again for when I go back to Europe for vacation. But
that's a really good one. I feel like my answer to this now is dumb compared to that, but I've always wanted to be able to like whoosh the tablecloth off of a table with nothing moving. It's like, what a baller move where you're at a very fancy dinner, we'll call it a gala, and somebody spills some red wine on the beautiful white tablecloth. And how amazing to stand up in my what would be wearing ball gown and just like, hua, like whip it off. And then I'm like, somebody change this. Like, I just feel like, but I'm never going to learn how to do that because I would absolutely smash every dish on that table. That being said, it has been so wonderful spending time with you and hearing your stories and your candor and your incredible tips and tricks. I can imagine there are folks that not only want to connect with you, but everybody probably wants to work for you now. So where can people go to read about you, learn about you, connect with you, and learn more about what your incredible company is doing?
Yes, I'd love to connect with everyone listening to this podcast. You can find me on LinkedIn. I'm Meredith Chandler. Or you can check me out on MeredithTheSalesCoach.com. I coach AEs, managers, companies, whatever you need, I'm here for you. So check me out, MeredithTheSalesCoach.com.
You heard it here, everyone. Meredith, thank you.
Thanks, Christina.
And that's all, folks.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of Taking the Lead. If you're looking for more inspiring stories from women leaders in B2B tech, then visit us at motionagency.io/takingthelead.